from well, I see your name is Luigi Miranda on Zoom here. Yeah, he's gonna, I guess I'll let you introduce your talk. Please go ahead.
Okay. Hello, my name is Luigi Miranda. I'm from Bucaramanga, Colombia. I am a master's student, and in this opportunity, I present the project Monitoring Soil Moisture and Chemical Composition Using Cosmic Ray Neutrons. Okay, we are in the middle of the climate change, and we must adapt to this situation. Adapt agriculture to make effective use for limited recourse as water and arable land. We need to optimize irrigation and fertilization by monitoring soil moisture and chemical composition. The Cosmic Ray Neutron sensor is proposed for this purpose because this device using cosmic ray neutrons that reach use constantly. This device are not invasive, and this device can cover areas into the order of hectares. Okay, the cosmic ray neutrons are produced when the primary cosmic ray interacts with atmosphere, and these neutrons, in general, the neutrons have two properties of interest. First, neutrons are moderated by water. That's to say, the neutrons response of a detector will be inversely right to the concentration of water present in the soil. And second, when they are a low energy in the order of millielectron volts, they can be captured by atom nucleus. And in this process, the nucleus emit a specific gamma photon, giving us a unique spectrum for each element. With the above, we have with one particle to determine the soil motion and the chemical composition. For this, a cosmic ray neutron sensor can be applied in the agriculture. And what are we doing? The simulation, the interaction of neutron over different city to determine how geographic variables, such for example altitude or geometric file, geomagnetic field affect the neutron flux. Because the American continent, and specifically the Latin America, has very rugged geography. Also, we simulate the interaction of neutron with soil of different chemical composition and motion, because we want to parametrize the data obtained with a simulation to generate calibration applicable to any cosmic ray neutron sensor. Okay, let's talk about the simulation. We integrate Corsica and GEM4. Corsica is for the first part of the atmosphere. The simulation starts at the top of the atmosphere and ends at 2 kilometers above the observation level. And we use GEM4 for the last part, for simulate the last part of the atmosphere and the interaction, the particles with the soil. In the observation level, we save the incoming and the outgoing neutrons from the soil. For the moment, we have some simulation in different cities and with different motion. We have a preliminary results, and first, the neutron flux we obtain has a similar behavior to the emissions sign. For example, we have a 3xF of neutrons in the expected energy range. And also, this data will be compared with the measurements of the Chilean Energy Commission. Second, in addition, simulation showed that the geographic variable that most affect the neutron flux reaching the ground is at, because, for example, when you, when in our simulation, when increase the altitude, increase to the neutron cones. Finally, we have a framework that allows to calibrate the cosmic ray neutron sensor, taking into account its geographic position from agricultural application. Thank you for your attention.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. That's a really interesting project. Are there any questions from the audience? Or comments or discussion? Okay, well, I guess I can go first. So, yeah, this is a really interesting project, and it seems like you've spent quite a bit of time on it. What, like, lot, really, really going forward long term, what do you hope to come from this?
Thank you, thank you. I don't understand because my internet is so not so good. Can you write the question, please? And
So,
I am.
what I'll try and speak very clearly for you. What are your long-term plans?
Okay, for the future.
Yes.
In the moment, we only have simulation for the. These cities. We need more simulation in more cities, but in more altitudes. And the second part is varying the motion in the soil and varying the humidity scale in the soil, because then the we have a little simulation. We are observing that when the is this the motion when the moisture present in the soil increase, then the nutrient cons decrease. Yeah. We observe the moderation, the neutron by the water. And the next step is observe how change the gamma photon or spectrum gamma photon when we change the chemical composition of the soil. In general, how this is for any cosmic ray neutron sensor, we, in general, and we don't need a device for this moment. The next step is via this device and parameterize the device with our simulation.
Brilliant, yeah, thank you. So yeah, it's a really nice display of using high energy physics to evaluate the environment and to look at the moisture content in the soil here, for example. Yeah, I like this project a lot. We do have like potentially
Thank you.
one more question. Sorry. We do have potentially space for one more question if there is any from the audience. A question in the chat is from Yako Tiswat. So, how can your research help agriculture?
Excuse me.
Can you see the chat? It's the question is
Yeah,
in the
yes. Okay. Because this is for the sector of agriculture that use a different technology is a precision agriculture. And in this type of for agriculture, use whatever technology. For example, a picture of satellites, a data, a big data. Whatever technology, and we think that with cosmic ray neutron sensor, we can help the problematic that we don't have infinite land and infinite water.
thank you for that. I hope that answers your question, Yako. Yes, he says thank you in the chat. Brilliant. So yeah, thank you so much for your talk and your time. It's very interesting work, and I invite everyone to give a quick round of applause in the a virtual round of applause. We'll be moving on to our next speaker, which is Diego Ruiz, if he is in the if he's connected. I think I can see him.
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Ah, yes, I see you. I can hear you too. Brilliant. Yeah, so if you wouldn't mind sharing, and please go ahead when you're ready.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me know if you can see my screen already.
Yep, that's good. Perfect. Thank you.
Perfect. All right. Well, thank you everyone for joining. I'm Diego, and I'm going to talk about flexibility in research infrastructures for global carbon neutrality project, also known as FlexRecon. So, well, you can see in the bottom of the screen all the partners and members of this project. The main objective that we have is to bring sustainable solutions for research infrastructures. So we have facilities like the European Spallation Source, the Extreme Light Infrastructure, for example, and all of us combined, we're trying to collaborate and find not just solutions, but yes, practices that will help reduce our environmental impact. It's not just about generating electricity in a sustainable way, but also optimizing our current practices and enhancing the way we use our resources. This is how FlexRecon is organized, and I'm showing this not for you to see how the structure is, but mostly what are we focusing on. We have a work package that goes for renewable energy production, energy storage, waste heat recovery. But it's not just about doing all of this and implementing it on site. It's also about doing it in a smarter way. How can we obtain the most benefits out of these technologies? So this is where the part of flexibility comes in. It's very important, not just using the things, but maybe if we're going to store energy, we can deploy it in a crucial moment or in a more relevant way and not just consume it when we can and when we have an excess, send it back to the grid. So I'm affiliated with ESS. If you don't know what it is, I'll briefly go through this slide. Just a linear accelerator, protons go to a target, neutrons come out to our instruments where eventually users will do their experiments. This is not very important. I think it's way more important to see how much we need to run a facility like this. This is the electricity that we will need for 2 MW operation. As you can see, immediately the accelerator just goes all over the top. It takes a lot of electricity, but not just that, it's also the cryogenics, central utility building, even the data center. So this is why it's a matter of utmost importance for us to reduce our energy consumption and also generate electricity in a more sustainable way. So how are we planning to do this? Well, first of all, I think it's very important to remember that our goal is to reduce. For example, if we set since the beginning to maintain operations of 2 MW and we have an initial energy estimation, we're able to reduce that and consume way less. We shouldn't just say, oh, well, then we can extend our operating hours or run certain systems at a higher rate. No, we're sticking to the 2 MW. And if we're able to reduce our consumption, that's fantastic. But we shouldn't aim to get more and just consume what we initially thought we were going to do. And also, we have the advantage that our site is quite big, so we can do it on site directly. It's not only going to make us more autonomous, but it will also reduce stress from the local grid, for example. We don't want to inject electricity if it's not really required. And finally, even though we're not in steady state operations yet, we're on a commissioning phase. Here's an example of a positive impact that ESS has had with early efforts for waste heat recovery. This is how our system looks like. And during our commissioning phases, our facility is already generating a lot of excess heat. So we're recovering this and we're using it for internal consumption, of course, all of our office buildings, tunnels, any kind of use we can have inside the facility where we take our heat from the one we generate. But then our excess heat, which is approximately, I think it's 100 gigawatt hour per year, give or take. Well, it's enough to cover between 12 and 15% of Lund's heat demand, which is the city where ESS is located. So even though we're not fully operational now, this is one of the things we've been focusing on since the beginning, and the impact that we can have is not just already relevant, but I think it shows the potential that this facility can have for when it's ready to accept users. So yes, that's it from my side. It's a very short talk, but I think was informative. Please let me know if you have any questions.
Brilliant, thank you. Are there any questions from the audience? I see Dwayne has raised his hand. Please go ahead.
Hi there, very nice talk. I have a quick question in terms of your impact. Do you have any records that you're trying to keep or ways you're trying to establish your embedded carbon in the site you already have and in the equipment you're using to maintain and operate your ESS in the future?
Yes, that's a complicated question. It's very interesting because I'm going to answer it in two parts, and I'll cheat a little bit because I'll start with the upgrade, which I think is going to be the easiest part. Right now we're aiming for 2 MW and eventually move all the way to 5. So yes, we are doing calculations to see what would be the impact of this update, of this increase in performance, how the equipment that we would need to replace or that will be reaching its end of life will accumulate to the emissions of the facility. And then for the first part of your question on what has been the impact so far, that's a little bit more tricky. ESS has been under construction for, might be wrong, but I think it's 20 years or so. Started around 1992, 95, somewhere around that time. Not exactly sure. So it's been a little bit hard to backtrace all the materials that have been used and all the equipment, but we do have a record for the most recent years, and we are starting to gather them and have a more organized, so to speak, database for that to make these calculations easier, because we do want to have a very clear view of the emissions that the facility has had so far and that we'll have in the future with upcoming upgrades, for sure.
Yeah, that's good to know, especially if you could potentially estimate your past emissions based on the amount of resource you know is used. For example, if you could calculate how much concrete you had in your facility, for example, then you could have an estimate of the embedded carbon as opposed to trying to measure it.
Yeah, precisely. And then I know this, that we have two main sources of concrete. One is here in Sweden, the other one's in Romania. So, we would have to take that into account, like how much of it came from another country, and then include transportation and shipping and all of that. But yes, we definitely want to have figures for that so that we can also compare and do further analysis for when an upgrade comes.
Thank you. Maybe a quick question from Jan.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. It's a quick one. Every time I see waste heat, I think it's a great idea, but it's also very seasonal. So what do you do with your waste heat during summertime? It's just wasted this time, or
That is an excellent question that we're also struggling a little bit with. We're in Sweden, so most of the year we have good use for it, but we right now I think we've been fine, but we are encountering problems with the local network here, Kraftringen. They're the ones who provide heating for Lund District. They might not be capable of receiving all the heat we generate during the summer, so we're trying to find a solution for that as well. We're analyzing if we can use it to preheat maybe some biomaterial for there's some biogas plants in Lund as well. Maybe we can help them some way. But I mean, that is a problem we have for sure, and or we will encounter, and we're exploring possibilities to fix it, but I don't have an answer or a solution right now for that.
Thanks.
All right, brilliant. Thanks so much. Thank you for your very succinct talk. But I hope we can have more discussions over the next days.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for joining. I would like to invite the next speaker, who is Davarin, please. Sorry, and also, yes, a virtual round of applause, please, for our speaker.
Can you hear me? It's not Davarin. It's actually, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay,
Would you
good.
like to?
But it's Patricia should be first part of the presentation. I mean, we just have a small part.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Patricia.
Yes, sure.
Yeah.
Hello,
Good.
everyone. So, can I
Oh.
share my presentation, or would you be sharing this?
No, you please go ahead.
Okay. Can you see my screen?
Yep, we see everything. Perfect. There
Yeah.
is a notification that blocks a little bit of your screen. So yeah, maybe hide that. And yeah, once you're ready, please go.
So greetings, everyone. My name is Patricia Buganova, and I'm part of the team at Eli Eric. We are a user facility focused on generating high-power laser beams. Today, together with my colleague Davorin Pacelli, we would like to briefly share how we are integrating sustainability into our operation and what specific steps we are taking to reduce our environmental impact. Operating high-power lasers requires massive amounts of energy, approximately 15 gigawatt hours per year, with around 10 gigawatt hours that is used just for maintaining indoor climate stability. Even the slightest deviation, more than 0.5 degrees of Celsius or 5% of relative humidity, can affect laser performance. So this creates a unique challenge for us. We must ensure extreme precision while minimizing our energy use and our carbon footprint. Currently, our technology systems emit over 4,000 tons of CO2 emissions annually, which is why sustainability has become a core part of our mission. We are addressing this challenge on multiple fronts. At first, we are investing in on-site energy generation, including cogeneration and photovoltaics. We are proud to be a partner in the European Horizon Project FlexRecan, which was presented during the previous talk. In this project, we are tackling key topics such as battery arrays integration, building management system area, and indoor climatic conditions management in highly sensitive research environments. The goal is to deliver transferable solutions for energy and climate management that other research infrastructures can adopt. And we are also developing a comprehensive ESG implementation roadmap to address all pillars of sustainability, not just the environmental one. Let me just briefly highlight two key technologies that we have implemented on our site. The first one is a photovoltaic system with over 300 kilowatt peak of installed capacity, already contributing to CO2 savings, and a high efficiency cogeneration unit that now covers part of our heating and electricity needs. Together, these on-site systems already supply 50% of our heating demand and approximately 17% of our electricity consumption. And with that, I will hand over to my colleague Davorin, who will guide you through the next step in our sustainability journey using a digital twin framework.
Okay, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Okay, you can go to the next slide. Okay, hi. My name is Davorin Pacelli. I'm a research scientist in Eli Beamlines. I work with machine learning and artificial intelligence, and I joined this group last year with the goal to build digital twin of our facility that should help us additionally optimize and control energy consumption and CO2 production, right? What is digital twin? Digital twin is a model of our facility, but in a way you can say that it's a live model. It's not just any model. So digital twin is continuously updated with real-time data from sensors and helps detect anomalies and make different kind of prediction and analysis using machine learning and artificial intelligence. Here you can see on this picture, you can see digital twin, in our case, is four parts. First is physical twin, basically it contains devices. And here where the data is collected, it also takes into account the weather outside. Then we go to data processing, detects anomaly on the level of data, not anomaly in the system. There's some cleaning of data transformation. Then we have a main part of digital twin system. First one is initial configuration. This is basically offline study, and we did this using Omega Alps. In our case, we already have some results, but in our case, it's very difficult. This is initial configuration. We already established facility, and initial configuration of facility is difficult to change. Second part is anomaly detection. This uses the real-time data. It's based on machine learning, supervised and non-supervised learning. And the last part here is real-time reconfiguration, which is based on usually, or in our case, on Monte Carlo research or reinforcement learning. And it does some what-if analysis and simulation, and based on data gathered and analysis, it gives some possible real-time reconfiguration suggestion. And then the last part, of course, is a decision maker that can do a user or maybe another AI, and basically tests if the changes in the system are efficient, energy efficient, and is it worth it to use, to make some kind of changes in the system. Yeah, that's all from me. Thank you. Patricia, can continue.
Yeah, thank you for your attention. If you have any questions, feel free to contact us or ask questions directly, and we welcome you to get more detailed information about our approach to sustainability on the listed QR code. Thank you.
Wonderful, thank you. I see a question from Dwayne again, please go ahead.
Hi, the use of a digital twin to model your facility is very interesting. What is your digital twin written in? Like, what programming language?
What programming language? So I work in Python. I think my colleague Pavel is working in Java, but I think most of the stuff will be done in Python because this is what I'm good at. So Python it is. Was that a question? Did I understand correctly?
Yep, that was the question. That was it, I think.
Okay.
Perhaps if we have another minute, if you are including, so within your digital twin, would you potentially be including, for example, environmental assessment results or life cycle assessment results? Is that in the scope?
I think so. I'm not sure what is it. Yeah, I said it there, we include the weather and the life cycle. I'm not sure what that is, but possibly yes. Maybe Patricia can answer that.
Yeah, maybe I can address this. Like at the beginning, we do not plan to include like life cycle assessments, but this is for sure like one of the idea for the future work. But for now, we are not planning to include this type of calculation because of its complexity.
I can imagine, yeah. But it does sound like an interesting idea forward in when you do have the it already set up.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you for that introduction and the overview. I don't think we have any more time for questions, but as Patricia said, you're welcome to contact them. I would like to say thank you very much for giving a talk and a virtual round of applause. I see a few people giving you a
thank
virtual.
You.
Thank you as well. Have a nice thank evening. Goodbye.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye. So then next, we have Dominic Graham. Are you there? Yes, I can see you. If
Yes,
you're
hi.
ready, please share your
Yes.
screen, and when you're ready, please go.
Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm Dominic Graham, and along with my supervisors, Chris Parks and Sylvia Borgie, on behalf of the LHCb collaboration, we'd like to present a life cycle assessment methodology for Large Hadron Collider detectors, quantifying embodied carbon dioxide equivalents from full simulation. So to begin with some context on environmental reporting at CERN, CERN reports its yearly carbon footprint and direct emissions from and energy usage, the so-called scope 1 and 2 emissions, and in addition, its latest report detailed company-wide scope 3 emissions for the first time, which are mainly from material procurement. This was a spend-based estimate which uses economic value to predict environmental impacts, and the results of all three scopes are shown in this graph. However, the collaboration of thousands of scientists from over 20 countries makes tracking exact supply chains difficult, leaving bespoke systems like the LHCb spectrometer without a complete bill of materials to derive these estimates. This leaves an open challenge in calculating these scope 3 emissions for LHC detectors. LHCb upgrade 2 is a major replacement of the detector system planned for the LHC's fourth long shutdown period in the 2030s. And its framework technical design report contains the first ever detector-wide impact assessment, projecting 4,400 tonnes of carbon dioxide equivalents per year, excluding the scope 3. This incentivizes more methodology for scope 3 emissions to allow a complete emissions profile and impact comparisons for detector and subdetector design plans. This is where simulation comes in. Simulation software is essential for the Large Hadron Collider in validating and processing results. These rely on extremely precise models of the system geometry and materials, known as a digital twin outside of high energy physics. We propose the repurposing of the digital twin to construct an automated estimate of the scope 3 emissions from simulated material. This provides an efficient, reusable method of assessing the so-called cradle-to-gate embodied carbon in Large Hadron Collider detectors, namely emissions from extraction of raw materials through to the end of material processing. This schematic presents an overview of the data processing workflow, where the implementation supports end-to-end automation of both the inventory extraction as well as impact assessments from processed data. This provides the first detector and subdetector-wide scope 3 impact assessments for LHCb and beyond. A critical challenge in large-scale life cycle analysis is the inventory extraction phase, where we take a detailed list of system inputs and outputs. For our scope 3 study, we simply want to consider post-processing material quantities, and these can be reconstructed from GDML data, which is an interoperable geometry format between the simulation software. We use analysis software root to parse the GDML and consider its hierarchical geometry structure to count components and compute their material and volume, producing the desired inventory. Using this method, we derived a 4,600 ton inventory for LHCb, which is 82% of the predicted total mass. This can be broken down further by subdetector, as shown in this graph here. We can identify any missing components using the visualizer tool, which for LHCb seems to be mostly in the holding platforms and support structures. Life cycle analysis database software is a widespread tool and reliable comparable impact assessments, offering a vast range of environmental data on common industrial materials and resources. We use inter-process communication with public database IDAMAP through the software OpenLCA and take midpoint indicators based on the Recipe 2016 hierarchies method, a standard in EPDs and industrial environmental assessments. After manual translation of materials into the database entries, we export the required desired impacts from the server. For this study, this was just the global warming potential. And lastly, a custom GUI aids user operability and allows subselection of database choices for sensitivity analysis. Some sample results are shown for the publicly available LHCb upgrade 1 files, but the concepts are transferable to any GDML compatible simulation. This yielded 13,000 tons of embedded carbon dioxide equivalents with 5% uncertainty from sensitivity analysis. For reference, this is on average equivalent to the embedded carbon of 170 British residential buildings and makes up about 3 times the annual scope 1 and 2 projections for upgrade 2 and 11% of CERN's annual scope 3 estimates. The methodology also supports identification of material hotspots and direct comparison of plan designs, and presents an automated and repeatable framework for quantifying detector and subdetector-wide scope 3 impacts. Thank you for listening, and we would like to thank the following people for their advice and collaboration in this project, and I'd be very happy to take any questions.
Wonderful. Thank you, Dominic. That was a really interesting overview. Are there any questions from the audience? I see one from Jan. Please go ahead.
Yes. Thank you. I was just wondering, maybe I misunderstood, but you mentioned accounting for 82 or 86%, I forgot, of the expected mass. Where is the rest? It's not part of the simulation of LHCb, or?
No, so that's the material that will never interact with the particle beam, such as the support structures and the holding material. That's the dominant contribution we were able to recognize as missing from the visualization.
I see. Thanks.
Shreyasi, I think your hand was up next.
So, yeah, very basic question before. So when is the upgrade supposed to start, and like, what is the duration of the runs that it will be taken after the upgrade?
Yeah, so I believe it's roughly a 5-year plan, so planned from the early to mid 2030s during the long shutdown for of LHC.
Okay.
Thank you. And Dwayne?
There were a couple of questions in the chat that came before me, so.
Oh, apologies, I didn't see those. So we have a question from Rocco. You mentioned that you can identify material hotspots. What material hotspots did you identify for LHCb?
That's a good question. So there's two options when it comes to considering material hotspots. We can either look directly at the impact data, so the GWP exported from the database. This is sort of the pre-process data, or we can look at the post-process data like we have here. And we can compare the quantities of material and the contribution to the CO2 equivalents. So a main factor that we found here was that inorganic materials made up only 0.5% of the mass and around 30% of the total emissions. And that's due to mainly concrete, which has a very high GWP from the calcination stage. So that was the main material hotspot, which had much less mass than CO2e contribution.
Thank you. Then another question in the chat was from Jaco. He says, very interesting. What is the LHCb's plan to actually do with the COE data?
So this will be used in these ongoing framework technical design reports. They're going to be standardized to have these environmental reporting sections, and this will allow much more repeatable automated estimations of the scope 3 emissions for those detectors and subdetectors. They can be used to compare alternative design plans that are being considered. If we're wanting to make choices to improve the sustainability of the design, this will help automate that process and make it easier to identify which choices will be most worthwhile.
He says thanks in the chat. So then it was Dwayne next, please.
Yeah, so this is actually fantastic, very interesting study. So when you mentioned this is the cost of the upgrade, obviously the entire detector might be changed, but there are going to be things that are going to stay the same, like maybe some of the support structures. Do you have an idea of how much of the existing detector will be recycled into the next upgrade? And if so, can you then estimate the amount of carbon that the support structures that you'll have to replace, that particles do not interact with, will add to this number that you've created?
Do you want me to take that one, Dominic?
yes, that might be for the best.
No, thanks very much. Very good question. Indeed, right. What we did at the moment was to use the existing full detector structure and just run it over the complete system. You're absolutely right. There are components we don't intend to change, like, for example, the magnet and the yoke of the magnet, parts of the muon system. Indeed, that's the kind of thing we would like to study in the future. Really component by component, looking at which parts we're expecting to change, which we aren't. And indeed, we have alternative plans for some components of the system, whereas Dominic said we'd like to look at alternative models for the different systems.
Thank you for that. And I think we can squeeze in one final question. Diego, please go ahead.
Oops. Thanks. Just want to ask, since in the previous talk, people from ELI also mentioned implementing a digital twin, how easy do you think it would be to implement your solution for a system like theirs, or if it would be possible at all?
So I suppose it would depend on the nature of the digital twin. So in this example, it's for GDML, it's a hierarchical geometry structure, which you can see an example of here. And this is a so-called composite solid or a Boolean solid. So these are able to be reconstructed en route. I believe it uses a Monte Carlo simulation for the more complicated geometries. But it would just sort of come down to finding a way of converting that into a different geometry format or a different digital twin. But I believe the main concepts are definitely transferable, yes.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Wonderful, thank you. Yeah, I personally find this very interesting and I look forward to seeing what more comes from it. So yes, I'd like to say a thank you to Dominic again, a virtual round of applause. And I'd like to welcome our final speaker of today. That will be Peter Millington. Please share your screen and go ahead when you're ready.
Thanks, Hannah. Hopefully everybody can hear me okay. Cool. Great.
Yes.
Well, firstly, thanks to all of the organizers for organizing this wonderful meeting and giving me the opportunity to put this advert and recruitment drive in at the end of this session. So I'm here from the Sustainable High Energy Cosmology and Astroparticle Physics Plus initiative, so the HECAP Plus initiative. And this was essentially set up at the end of during the first Sustainable HEP workshop that took place in, if I remember correctly, June 2021. And the idea, the initial idea of that initiative was just to try and put down on paper some reflection of the current status of environmental sustainability in these fields of research. And the plus here really refers to any areas of big science that rely on similar infrastructure to, say, high energy physics or cosmology and astroparticle physics. So things like hadron and nuclear physics are good examples. And the work that we've been doing so far, so that reflection document was completed over a course of about 3 years and is now published in GINST. And by all means, please have a look at that document. And since then, we've been working on trying to build various initiatives to drive forward sustainability across these fields. And this has involved working with particular stakeholders. So members of the initiative have worked directly with the LDG, with funders, national funders, the archive and other community consortia and initiatives to support and drive forward environmental sustainability and to try and enable environmental sustainability across these fields. One thing to look out for coming forwards is a large interdisciplinary and international workshop on green computing that hopefully will be announced soon. And again, members of the initiative involved in driving that forward. And so this talk, which hopefully will be very, very short, it's just this one slide, is really a call for people to get involved if you're interested. And we're really looking for essentially anyone with great ideas and enthusiasm and motivation and willingness to give time, which unfortunately at this stage is voluntary to pushing forward the sustainability agenda within our fields of big science. So we're looking for anybody interested in developing our new website. And this could be any aspect, right? So if you're you know, you have a good head for resources on environmental sustainability that might be relevant to members of our field, then, you know, please come forward and help us build that catalog of helpful resources and put that together in the website. And if you're not interested, but you know someone else who is, then please put them in touch with us. And we're also interested in getting in touch with anybody who wants to contribute to analyses of environmental impacts for particular aspects of either the research infrastructure that we work with or just our research practices more generally. So this could feature aspects of, say, travel, for instance. And we're also looking at an initiative to engage with other sustainability initiatives. And we've been very lucky to receive some generous support from the United Kingdom Science and Technology Facilities Council, FTFC. And that's given us a little bit of infrastructure resources in terms of managing initiatives and sort of document sharing and building websites and GitHub teams to help build these initiatives and little work packages. So if there's something that you want to do, if there's something that you want support for, then please do get in touch with us because we might be able to help you push that forward. So that's basically everything I wanted to say, but please do get in touch with us. The general mailbox email address is there, info@hecap.eco. But also if you don't like generic emails, then by all means, feel free to contact me and my hecap email is there, pete@hecap.eco. So please do get involved. Please do get in touch and we really look forward to hearing from you. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Pete. Are there any questions from the audience? I don't see any immediate hands up. I will say quickly, Pete, are you sure your HECAP Eco email is correct? I thought it was millington@hecap.eco.
I have lots of aliases, so I thought I'd put the most friendly Perfect. One in.
Perfect, as long as that's fine. Yeah, okay, well, thank you so much for sharing that. And I hope at least someone in the audience finds that interesting. And even if you just want to find out a little bit more, I think Peter will be willing to hear from you. Okay, well, with that, I think that comes to the end of our day. So I'd like to say a big, big thank you to all of our previous speakers, those online and those who have already left. I think they've made the first day a resounding success, and it has been very, very interesting from my point of view on its own. I'd like to say that tomorrow we have a great lineup, if that's the right word. We have a panel talking about the future of high energy physics and facilities with contributors from DAISY, from Triumph, and from STFC. And we also have a kickoff talk from Professor Kenneth Bloom, which promises to be very interesting. So I really do hope you join us tomorrow, and I wish you a good afternoon, good evening, or good night.